The next case is 09465, Disciplinary Counsel versus John Thaddeus Willard. Ms. Costa.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Carol Costa on behalf of Disciplinary Counsel. At this time, Your Honor, may I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal,
sure,
please?
Watch your time there.
On October 7th, 2006, respondent was first contacted by Foreclosure Alternatives to assist David and Annette Chandler in a foreclosure case involving their home of 18 years. 4 days later, on October 11th, respondent filed a motion to strike the foreclosure complaint. The Chandler's home was sold through a sheriff's sale on October 23rd. On October 7th, 2006, respondent knew there was nothing he could do to help the Chandlers. Their foreclosure case had already gone into default, and the sheriff's sale had already been ordered by the court. Respondent told Foreclosure Alternatives, the company, that there was nothing that he could do and that he didn't want to get involved. But he did anyway. For whatever reason, the company dropped the ball in this case. But that's not the issue here. One of the issues here is that respondent helped perpetuate the scam that Foreclosure Alternatives created and allowing the Chandlers to think there was nothing wrong with their case. They thought everything was fine. They knew nothing to the contrary until they read the newspaper and saw the ad for the sheriff's sale of their home. Respondent never spoke to the Chandlers, never met with the Chandlers, never wrote to the Chandlers. And the Chandlers aren't the only clients affected in this case. Out of the 28 to 30 clients that respondent dealt with after being referred by Foreclosure Alternatives, he only ever spoke to three or four, and that was after the clients called him. Respondent never advised the Chandlers of any options since he never talked to them, but he never advised any of the other 28 to 30 clients of any options that they could have early on in the foreclosure proceedings, such as bankruptcy. The first time respondent advised any of the clients of the possibility of bankruptcy to help them was if a summary judgment motion had been filed, and then he would send the client a letter. Respondent never negotiated with the creditors, with the lenders in this case. That was all left up to Foreclosure Alternatives, the company. Respondent had no idea what training the non-lawyers in the company had, and no idea what the company was talking about with the lenders. And despite the fact that respondent never had any information other than the initial foreclosure complaint that he received from the company, he went ahead and filed boilerplate pleadings on behalf of these clients. Last year, the court decided the case of Cincinnati Bar Association versus Mullaney. That case has the same facts as found here. The same methods were used by the foreclosure help company. In fact, you could pretty much change the names in the opinion, and it would be the same case as we have here today. The court's analysis of those facts and the rule violations is right on point. But we would respectfully submit that the court's sanction in that case, the most of which was a one-year stayed suspension, is inappropriate. And no objection was filed in that case. There's harm in these cases. The harm is a violation of the basic duties a lawyer owes a client. There's no communication with the client. There's no advice to the client. There's no independent judgment exercised by the lawyer after an analysis of the facts. And in the Chandler case, there was no communication by respondent after assuming the representation that there was nothing they could do to save their home. The estate planning and trust mill cases offer some guidance as to the sanction. Those cases, which are cited on our brief, Wheatley, Fishman, Kathman, all involve some actual time off from the practice. They all involve situations where the lawyer did not talk to the client about their case, did not try to get facts from the client, did not try to determine what the client's objectives are, and they basically just, as the court noted in Fishman, basically just looked over the shoulders of the Trust Mill Company.
Counsel, in the Mullaney case, there was substantially more cases that the attorney had touched than what we have here?
Yes.
We have 30 at best, and there were a couple thousand?
I believe about 2,000. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. How do you address, if Mullaney resulted in a one-year state suspension, correct?
Yes.
And what are you asking for here?
1 year with 6 months stayed.
Okay.
So 6 months off.
I guess I'm interested in why this would be deserving of a more strident sanction than Mullaney. That's my question. Okay.
Well, Your Honor, Mullaney really didn't get into the harm to these people. Now, respondent would have you believe that because there was nothing that could be done to help the Chandler's case, there's no harm. But that's not what the focus should be. We're going back to step one of being a lawyer. Talk to your client, communicate, give advice, look at the facts. And this court has asked on a number of occasions in these types of cases, what kind of message are we sending to the public? And what kind of message are we sending to attorneys?
Well, did Mullaney talk to the 2,000 clients?
No.
And I'm presuming that he had clients that were in the same boat as the Chandlers?
There was nothing in the Mullaney opinion that anything went into default, but the pattern of getting a case from the foreclosure company, just filing the boilerplate pleading, not talking to the clients and so forth is, from what I can read, exactly the same. But the point is, we've seen these types of cases in the trust mill situation. We've seen them in the estate planning situation. And now, unfortunately, with the climate, with all of the foreclosures that we read about every day in the paper, these types of companies are popping up.
There was not a finding, and I know you think it's not relevant but or important, but there was not a finding in Mullaney, I don't think, that there was nothing the lawyer could have done for the parties there, was there?
I don't believe so, Your
Honor. And that's your issue, that's your primary issue here, that the board, even though there was a stipulation that there was a violation of those two sections of the code by the parties, including the respondent, that the board found there was not a violation of DR, I don't have them right in front of me here, but the two sections that
right.
The go to prepare a lawyer's duty to be prepared for representing a client.
I think factually, Your Honor, there's two issues. We have the Chandlers, a specific client in this case, and we have the rest of the clients whom respondent admits he never talked to, never advised of any of their rights, and so on and so forth. Yes, one of our requests here is that the court find that the respondent violated 6101A2, which was stipulated to, and that's not handling a case with adequate preparation. And the other count that the board dismissed was 7101A1, which is failure to seek the client's objectives. Those were found in Mullaney. And I would submit to the court that it's impossible to comply with those two provisions if a lawyer never even talks to the client.
Ms. Costa, in Mullaney, there were two defendants, correct?
Three, Your Honor.
Or three, but one of the defendants who had not had any previous experience in the disciplinary cases received a public reprimand, correct?
That's correct.
And there was a violation of five separate sections there.
I believe it was six, Your Honor. We allege the same six code violations that were found in Mullaney. And the board in this case, as well as Mullaney, obviously, found all of the UPL-related case code violations. Here, they didn't find the preparation and seeking the objectives, but those were all set forth and found in Mullaney.
Right, and there was no objection filed by either the respondent or the relator to the sanctions that were suggested there?
Not in Mullaney. It went right to the court after the board opinion was filed.
I'm curious about the board's conclusion that, again, back to the 6101A2, that there's no evidence, there was no evidence that a better prepared attorney could have represented the clients any better. A better prepared attorney would have known, I guess, that maybe the lawyer here did know, didn't tell them, as you indicate, but a better prepared attorney would tell the client, there's nothing I can do for you, and therefore not charge the client, although here, of course, he got paid through the unauthorized practice of law company.
That's exactly it, Your Honor. Respondent here admitted he knew there was nothing he could do for these people. It was already in default. The sheriff's sale had already been ordered, I believe, 2 months, if not more, before. He told the company, there's nothing I can do. I don't want to get involved.
So he was...
He did anyway.
He was prepared. So I guess the question is, how do we interpret the language in our rule, better prepared? Better prepared suggests that the lawyer didn't research, didn't know the facts, didn't know the record, hadn't interviewed the client. But here the lawyer was prepared enough that he knew, at least he thought he couldn't do anything for them.
He knew because there was a default and because the sheriff's sale had been ordered. But as far he testified in the hearing, he had no idea what these people's debts or assets were. He had nothing other than that foreclosure complaint. He had no clue as to what, if anything, these people wanted done. And at the very least, he had an obligation, once he assumed that representation, he believed that they were his clients, to pick up the phone and, like we all have done with clients, tell them something unpleasant or tell them something they didn't want to hear, but something they had a right to hear from the attorney representing them.
Were all the clients that they were referred already in foreclosure and at sheriff's sale?
Well, not necessarily to a sheriff's sale. All of the clients, how foreclosure alternatives worked was they checked the dockets for foreclosure complaints, just like in Mullaney. Then they would send out a mailing.
Because when in Mullaney, one of the things we criticized was the attorneys failing to give them other options, such as the bankruptcy and other issues. And in Mullaney, there was a lot of boilerplate correspondence, not direct one-on-one contact, but boilerplate correspondence, where one of the things they suggest is you might want to check with the bankruptcy attorney. That didn't seem to happen here at all.
No. In the mailings that were, and I want to make sure I distinguish between what the company was doing and what respondent was doing, because they're two separate things. But the mailings that were sent from the company said, bankruptcy is a last resort. We will contact your creditor. The respondent.
Mulaney, the law firm themselves followed up with individual correspondence. Here, I don't see anything in the record that this attorney followed up with individual correspondence.
Not with the Chandlers. But with the other people, all he did, he never would talk to them when he got the initial complaint. He would file a boilerplate answer, send those people a letter saying, I'm your attorney in this matter, here's the answer. If you can think of any other defenses, please call me.
He expects them to think up defenses themselves.
Exactly. And only three or four ever did. They called him. He never called them. And he was asked at the hearing, Your Honor, about do you expect these people to know their defenses? And I don't exactly remember the quote, but it wasn't all that clear. But I'm a lawyer. I've never done bankruptcy work. I don't know what the defenses are. I can't imagine any lawyer legitimately believing that a client is going to know those and call them up and say, hey, please include this.
I guess I'm still questioning, I'm following up on that question, still questioning this conclusion that there was nothing the lawyer could have done for the Chandlers. I mean, and his argument was in his motion to dismiss, filed very belatedly, was that Wells Fargo was not the real party in interest. And there's some courts, some judges, who will not grant foreclosure. Won't sign a foreclosure entry unless the judge knows exactly who the party is. And I guess I'm wondering this conclusion that there was nothing he could do. Should we not go behind that, or we just assume that everybody involved here assumes that nothing he could have done, the lawyer could have done for the Chandlers?
Well, he looked at it as a last shot. He told the company, I don't want to get involved. There's nothing I can do. He never did any independent research to determine whether or not this was a legitimate pleading.
Well, that would go to the prepared issue.
Exactly.
Maybe there was something he could have done, because these cases, as we know, things happen in these foreclosure cases that are a little unusual,
and
because courts are trying to help the parties come together or save the contract or whatever. And that's why I'm questioning this conclusion that was made, that there was nothing he could have done. I don't see any rationale for that, other than that the court had already put on a default judgment.
And granted, these cases can be a mess, but all he had was that complaint. He never called them, never checked with anybody else, just filed this motion to strike 4 days later, claiming that time was of the essence. When he testified on deposition, from start to finish, reviewing the complaint, making the pleading, it took him 2 hours. And he also testified, Your Honor, on page 92 of the transcript, that he didn't call the Chandlers because he didn't believe a five-hour conversation with them would have accomplished anything. He didn't want to talk to the Chandlers. He didn't want to talk to these other people.
He got his $150 that he routinely gets, and that's what
exactly.
That's the impression one gets from the record.
Exactly.
You've used your time, Ms.
Thank you, Your Honor. We would ask that the court find the additional violations we allege, as well as issue a sanction of 1 year with 6 months' stay.
Thank you. Mr. Weil.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, on behalf of Mr. Willard, I want to cover two basic issues. Number one, the violations to the sanctions. But I think it's important to start with the sanctions that are being objected to, because that's really at the heart of this case. And Your Honor brought up really what begs the question in this case. You have Mullaney and you have the Willard case. What is the difference? When that question was posed to disciplinary counsel, the only thing I heard in response was, we need to send a message. And I asked the court to take a look at, is this the case, is this the attorney that needs a message sent to him? The mitigating factors in this case are strong for Mr. Willard. He has practiced law for 40 years with no prior violations. The board found that he lacked any dishonest or selfish motive in his actions. And he has been cooperative throughout this entire process. Also, if you look at Mullaney versus the Willard case, there are many more aggravating factors with Mullaney. As the justice alluded to, we're talking about 2,000 cases. Willard touched between 28 and 30. You're talking about harm being presented in the Mullaney case with regard to the clients versus no evidence of harm with regard to the folks in this case, the Chandlers. Mr. Willard has expressed a full understanding of the rules violations, and he has withdrawn himself from this entire area of practice. And he has not objected to the other findings of the violations. We do want to point out, with the violations that the board did not find, 6101 and 7101, I think it is important to realize that it all began on October 7th for Mr. Willard, but it was 2 months beyond the time where a default judgment had been entered, an order of sale had been scheduled, when he gets involved. He believes at that time there's nothing likely he could do, but he decides to take some action and files his motion to dismiss based on a real party and interest type argument. What is important to point out is that in Mullaney, there was expert testimony presented with regard to these two violations, 6101, 7101. In this case, there was no such expert testimony presented on behalf of the relator. What the evidence exists in this case is that Mr. Willard came in, was dealt a difficult hand with respect to this particular case, and tried to take some action on behalf of his clients. Obviously, he should have done a lot of things differently, and that's why there are rules violations that were found and not objected to on his behalf. He should have met with the clients. He should have done a lot of things differently. He didn't. But you're left with the evidence before you being that in Mullaney, those attorneys all received either a one-year stayed suspension or a public reprimand. Mr. Willard ends up with a one-year stayed suspension, and we ask that the findings of the board with regard to both the violations and with regard to the recommendation of sanctions be accepted by the court. That's all I have, unless you have any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Weil.
Thank you.
Ms. Costa, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
May it please the court. Counsel indicated that respondent is no longer dealing in this type of area. On the transcript on page 94, he stopped dealing with foreclosure alternatives because they weren't paying him. We have an obligation to protect the public, and in this case, it's the most basic obligations of an attorney to his client, to communicate and advise and counsel.
Was the Mullaney case contemporaneous with this in terms of time, or had it already come out before he took these cases up?
No, Mullaney came out last year. Mullaney came out while our investigation, why the board case was pending.
So he did not have notice of Mullaney?
No. That's why, members of the court, we would ask for an additional sanction in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Costa. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.